Good afternoon. The first case this afternoon is case number 69886, KKL Inc. versus State Department of Taxation. We have Mr. Brown and Ms. Ferrario for the appellants. Mr. Tartakovsky. Thank you. Are you going to be splitting your time?
Split the time equally. I'll be addressing jurisdiction. Mr. Ferrari will address the First Amendment issue. Right. Unless the court, of course, would prefer.
No, it's fine. When you hit 7.5 minutes, I'm going to let you know. All right.
I'd actually like to reserve 2 for rebuttal, so maybe 5.
Okay, I'll watch it for you.
Okay.
Mr. Brown, go ahead.
Thank you very much. May it please the Court, William Brown on behalf of the appellants at Zephyr Shack, LLC. This case presents 2 issues, essentially, the first of which is the jurisdictional question. Jurisdiction is proper for at least 3 reasons in this case. The first reason has to do with the second decision issued by the Nevada Tax Commission. The decision was issued on February 12, 2014, and the appellants filed a petition for judicial review within 30 days of that decision on March 11, 2014. So setting aside whatever may have happened prior to that decision, district court had jurisdiction because there was a timely PJR of the second tax commission decision. Notably, the second decision in the tax commission is never addressed in the brief by the state. So this question really is left unanswered. The second reason is that the argument being espoused by the department that filing a de novo action divests a district court of subject matter jurisdiction has been considered and at least impliedly rejected twice by this court. The first time was in Southern California Edison. That involved the filing of a de novo action. There was no finding that divested the court of jurisdiction to consider the tax commission ruling. In fact, this court ruled that that case could proceed as a de novo action. So that was the first case in which a de novo action was sufficient to vest the district court with jurisdiction to consider a tax commission decision. Excuse me. The second division opinion is tax department versus district court. This was a July 7, 2011 opinion. In this case, this court ruled 2 things. Number one, the 90-day filing term in the statute at issue, 372.680, applied in place of the more general 30-day rule set forth in the APA. In that case, there was also a filing of a de novo action. The tax department argued there, as it is here, that filing a de novo action does not vest the district court with jurisdiction. And, in fact, that de novo action was allowed to proceed as a PJR. So I think that on two different occasions, taxpayers have filed a de novo action based on language that is identical to the language at issue in the statute here. And this court has at least impliedly decided that filing a de novo action does not divest a court of jurisdiction to review a tax commission ruling. So I think twice the court has considered and at least impliedly rejected the argument that's being made before the court now. The third thing I would say is that deja vu one never expressly holds that filing a de novo action divests a court of jurisdiction. The district court's ruling in this case was 2-part. Number one, the court cannot consider a de novo action, so that is being dismissed. Number two, this matter is going to proceed as a petition for judicial review. Exactly what this court ruled was a proper procedure in tax department versus district court. In deja vu one, the court affirmed the lower court's decision, saying, yes, you correctly found that you did not have jurisdiction to consider de novo action. The court, however, did not go on and consider the second part of the court's ruling, whether the district court had the authority, the jurisdiction, to allow the case to continue as a petition for judicial review. So I think essentially the tax department case has considered the issue that's before the court now. And in that case, this court correctly held that filing a de novo action does vest a district court with jurisdiction to consider a final decision by the Nevada Tax Commission.
Counsel, I follow your logic, and I don't necessarily disagree with your argument, but we've had a pretty healthy time delay in the filing of the various PGRs, 2 to 3 and 3 to 4. We had a filing back in 2008 and a filing in 2014. They seem to be way outside of our normal statutory timelines. Your basic logic is fine, but I'm trying to fit these timelines in and also dealing with the Otto case as well as having all the pertinent parties in. How do you respond?
So the specific question has to do with the lapse
timelines
in time.
Timelines, number one, and Otto not naming all the proper parties, and whether that makes it effective at any time.
In terms of including deja vu?
Jurisdiction, yes.
Right. I think inadvertently including parties that should not have been included in the first place does not divest the court of jurisdiction. That would be, I guess, my response to the correctly naming the parties. And I agree, strict compliance with the statute is required, and typically the cases addressing that deals with naming the respondent as the correct party. I'm not familiar with any cases that says listing a petitioner incorrectly or a party who's not properly a petitioner divest the court of jurisdiction as long as the proper petitioners are listed. In terms of the time lapse, I would say there is a significant time lapse between the 2007 decision and PGR filing in 2011, without question. There is not, however, the same time lapse between the February 2014 Tax Commission decision and the March 11, 2014 petition for judicial review. That's squarely within the 30-day period, which I think is even short considering that a 90-day time period probably applies in this situation. I guess my response to the initial time lapse would be that the complaint for refund, the de novo action, was filed within 90 days of the final decision. And in a situation where a de novo action is timely filed, at least in Southern California Edison and in tax department, the result has been a district court is allowed to consider the action under the PJR standard, even if it was not a petition that was actually formally filed to begin with.
You're down to about 8 minutes and 20 seconds. You want to reserve your 2 minutes?
Please.
Mr. Ferrario.
Good afternoon, Mark Ferrario for the appellants, and I have been assigned the First Amendment aspect of this argument, and I hate using cliches, but I think one may be apt, the third time's a charm for us here. It's not lost on me that you have considered two prior cases and considered the First Amendment challenges we articulated then, and we respect your ruling. I think you know our view of the law because we argued it prior to the decision in the Reed case, and you didn't see it our way. But what has happened is the United States Supreme Court has come down with a new case, and that's Reed versus City of Gilbert. And that case amounts to a, from our perspective, a sea change in this area. And I think you probably all read it, but what the Supreme Court has now said in no uncertain terms is that if a law is content-based, a law that impacts speech is content-based, then it has to be viewed under the strict scrutiny standard. And they say that very clearly, and they reiterate it throughout the course of that opinion. And they don't say that a law that just deals with signs or a law that just deals with this. They say any law, any statute. And I submit to you that when you look at the, as we say, gerrymandered live entertainment tax statute at issue here, that it is beyond question that that law is content-based. And how do we know that? Because the only way you know if you can tax somebody is to look at the content of the message they're sending. That's the only way you can do it. How do we know that? Well, I'm aware that there are lines of cases that say you should look at legislative history and you shouldn't, and I'm not going to debate which one will follow here, and I'm aware of the cases that say the sine qua non is not the legislative intent. But here, if you look at the legislative intent, if you look at the record behind the passage of this tax statute, it was unequivocally designed to target our clients. And there's no dispute as to that. And they use words when they're going to exempt NASCAR or they're going to exempt some other type of entertainment as family friendly. Well, they're promoting family friendly, but they're targeting adult entertainment. And that, under the Reed case, is simply not permissible any longer. And the Supreme Court has made that clear. So whatever...
If the tax is on, and this is a tax as to admission, not on, as you, your argument, and I understand your position, you are saying subject matter, but from the other standpoint, it's for admission, not on the type of admission, and I guess that's...
Well, Justice Douglas, I appreciate that, but I'm going to go back to the comment that you, this court made, and I think it was Deja Vu 2, where you said, well, there's a misnomer. The calling it a live entertainment tax is a misnomer. No, it's not. That's what's going on here. They're taxing entertainment. Whether you tax somebody going in, okay, or you tax a performer, it's still a tax on entertainment. I think this is really an artificial distinction.
Artificial or not, the Supreme Court has allowed this distinction that you wish to say is artificial. I mean, that's a stock and trade artificial. How do you deal with Leathers versus Medlock, a U.S. Supreme Court that held First Amendment context is a strong presumption in favor of duly enacted taxing schemes?
I can't dispute that. That case is there. That's what they said in Leathers, but that was pre-Reed. And now, if you take a tax scheme, but the only way you can determine if the tax is to be paid is to look at the content of the speech being taxed, then you're into a Reed context. Because now you have a law that is content-based. And that's the difference. And there hasn't been a revisiting of a Leathers-type case post-Reed.
Well, you are giving a very expansive reading of the Reed case outside of what is in the four square of the Reed opinion.
Well, actually, I'll quote from the, and I was anticipating questions like that, so I actually like to go, every once in a while, you go back to what the court says. The court says, on one section, 2227, government regulation of speech is content-based if a law applies to particular speech because of the topic discussed or the idea or message expressed. That's exactly what we have here. The only way you can determine whether to apply the live entertainment tax is to look at the content of the speech. That's it. I was thinking of an example. I don't think the state would be here advocating in favor of this statute if it said, if the only thing that was being taxed was live entertainment at gentlemen's clubs. It would be a targeted tax, and it would be aimed right at my clients, and it would be discriminatory on its face. We wouldn't be here if the tax was, we'll tax all live entertainment, because then it's not content-based. What happens is you now have to look at this statute and you have to see what is being said, what is the message being sent, before you can decide on whether the tax applies. And that's what you can no longer do without applying a strict scrutiny analysis under Reed. And that's what Reed says. And it talks about, and the court goes on, 2227. The common sense meaning of the phrase content-based requires a court to consider whether a regulation of speech on its face draws distinctions based on the message a speaker conveys. And that's exactly what we have here. And that's exactly what the legislative history shows. This tax was gerrymandered based upon the message of the speaker. And there's no dispute as to that. I can go on through the opinion. It says, and this is later on, I think 2228. A law that is content-based on its face is subject to strict scrutiny, regardless of the government's benign motive, which speaks to what you said, Justice Douglas.
content-neutral justification, or lack of animus toward the ideas contained. Here, though, we have animus towards the ideas contained in my client's speech. And that's evidenced in the legislative history. If I could, I'd reserve the last 48, 47 seconds that I have.
Why don't you use your 44 seconds? I'll give your counsel 2 minutes. I'll give Mr. Tarkovsky an extra 2 minutes.
Okay. And the court goes on to talk about, you know, you don't have to have a bad motive or anything like that. And then finally, the court says on page 2229, the vice of content-based legislation is not that it is always used for invidious thought control purposes, but that it lends itself to use for those purposes. And that's exactly what we have here. So, I understand what you said in Deja Vu 1. I understand what you said in Deja Vu 2. But you didn't have Reed. And Reed marks a sea change in this area of the law.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer.
Chief, if I may, if I've sure. got one question. I'm still having trouble reconciling Leathers versus Medlock as a tax matter with Reed. And so I see a distinction there, and can you address that at all?
Excuse me?
Can you address that at
yes,
all?
Yes. Justice Perry, we argued Leathers the first time. We argued the paper case Minneapolis. We argued all those cases. Okay, and you guys, when you issued your decision, you disagreed with us. Okay, the distinction is just as I articulated. When you read the case, the Reed case, it doesn't create an exception for tax cases. It says any law. And that would include a tax law. So whether Leathers is good law or not, at the Supreme Court level, I would submit it isn't any longer. If you're dealing with a content-based distinction. And that's the difference here. So Reed is a sea change. And there's no, it doesn't say any law but tax laws. And I understand the jurisprudence that says you have to give discretion and deference to legislators when they're fashioning tax statutes. But even in that arena, in the Minneapolis Star case, it was an innocent enough tax, was it not, on ink and paper? And they found, the Supreme Court looked at that and said, wait a minute, that's targeting somebody. You can't do that. And then the jurisprudence meanders all over the place, and I would submit a lot of it is results, any oriented jurisprudence. We could take five cases and argue as we did the first time around, and they could take five cases, and you know what? You agreed with them on those five. But now we have Reed, and Reed is different. And that's why we're here. That's why, if all I was doing was getting up and rehashing Leathers, Minneapolis Star, and the rest of them, I'd be wasting your time. You would have probably cut me off about 7.5 minutes ago. But that's the difference.
Well, I was just looking at the language in Leathers, and there's some pretty significant, dramatic language in there that causes me to think there's a distinction.
Well, I understand your point, and you can sort. I can't change what Leathers says, and I can't change the sequence of Reed. I can just go back to you and read what Justice Thomas said when he was writing for the majority, and this is at 2228. A law, and he didn't say except tax laws, that is content based on its face is subject to strict scrutiny. So, whether it's a tax law, whether it's a sign law, whether it's some other kind of law, if it's content based, it's subject to strict scrutiny. That's what the court said in Reed. And it's been applied outside the sign context as we cited in our papers. So, coming back full circle, Reed was a departure from prior jurisprudence. And it requires, I think, this court to revisit this issue and not simply go back to pre-Reed cases that may have justified your ruling the first time around. We can't ignore the latest pronouncement from the Supreme Court on content-based regulation that impacts First Amendment rights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferrario. Mr. Martin, I'm going to give you your 2 minutes, but Mr. Tartakovsky, I'm going to give you 18 minutes. You don't have to use 18 minutes, but just be even handed. Be my guest.
Joseph Tartakovsky for the state of Nevada. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Unless the court has questions, I'll go straight to the constitutionality question. The witticism we prefer to use is that this is deja vu all over again. That wasn't just an attempt at quit. We were saying that you have literally heard and decided this case before. 34 out of 54 pages that you read for today's hearing, you read in the 2013 case. So I'll just focus on what they claim is different, which is the Reed decision. It caused a dramatic departure. It was a sea change. The problem with that, I think, is that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't think it was doing that. They seem to be engaged in a straightforward application of their own precedent. They said it was the Ninth Circuit that had engaged in a novel interpretation. They overruled none of their precedents. It was a unanimous judgment. The concurrence said it was an easy case, and they just thought that the majority went further than it needed to go. Reed has no application here, because Reed is a case about a direct regulation of speech. This was an ordinance that said, you tell us what you are going to say on your sign. We will read that sign, and then we will tell you what degree of regulation applies. This, as you said in Deja Vu 1, is an excise tax on business transactions. The Supreme Court has always kept its direct regulation of speech and its taxation cases separately, because they're one very large step removed. The former gets involved in the substance of speech, how someone expresses it, the means. The other taxes profit-making, revenue-growing activities. For instance, the state cannot tell a newspaper what sort of advertisements it can run or not run. It can't tell an author what to write in his or her book. But it can tax newspapers, and it can tax book sales. This is because one interferes with expression or substance, the other one just is a tax on business, no different than a tax on any business. They don't get a pass just because they happen to make their profits off activity that underlying which involves some expressive activity. Expressive activity is irrelevant. If they have all clothing day and all the dancers come out clothed, same tax. And it's the exact same rate that the opera pays, or the ballet, or a rodeo. Every tax has to name that which is taxed. If you have a mining tax, do we say, oh, that's content-based, you're singling out mining, that's illegal? You have to mention what you're taxing. Now, if a law got involved in the business of regulating expression, which, as I say in Deja Vu 1, you said it had no effect, it doesn't lay a finger on expression. It said, well, the mining industry can't lobby, the mining industry can't do this or that, affecting speech, different matter altogether. Taxing business profits is perfectly legitimate. There are very few reasons that the state has to get involved in telling people what they can't say, how to say it. There are about a million reasons why a legislature taxes, a million reasons why it exempts certain things, it frames tax regulations and laws in different ways. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court said in Leathers, in order to not have every tax law be subject to infinite challenges under the First Amendment for differential treatment, the legislature has to have an enormous amount of latitude, the highest amount of latitude. So they set out the standard that in order to take out a tax law on a First Amendment theory, you have to show that it involves the most hostile, you have to make the most explicit demonstration that it involves hostile and oppressive discrimination targeted at a specific class. That's their standard, and they can't prove it. And I can prove that they can't prove it in two ways. They say we pay the vast majority of the tax. What could be more striking than a tax supposedly on all live entertainment in Nevada is shouldered just by this one narrow industry? We know that's not true. We know that they pay 5% of the LET. The key document is that Appellant's Appendix 171 and 172. This is a spreadsheet that was produced during discovery that shows exactly how much the strip club industry pays as a percentage of the total LET per year. And it says that for most of the 2000s, they paid about 5% of the tax. They paid 5% of the tax because that's their corresponding share of the tax on live entertainment. We know this also from the text and operation of the statute. This is a tax broadly on live entertainment, which is very broadly defined, anything where there's sort of one human being doing something that amuses another human being. What I would like to suggest to the court, put maybe a different spin to help illustrate it, slightly different than in our briefs. The only two true exemptions, there's this list of 23, they make a lot of this. The only two true exemptions in this statute are for the NASCAR, one NASCAR race, and for the minor league baseball. The rest of them, you should think of more in the way of clarifications in order to avoid what would be surprising or unfair taxation. These exemptions, as they've been referred to, really do things like this. The piano player at the mall, his presence does not convert the mall into a concert venue. If a Spanish restaurant hires a flamenco player, this says that no, since people are coming to dine, this is just background, we're not converting this into a concert hall. You have to pay your restaurant taxes and your live entertainment taxes. Casual assemblages, the band at a wedding or a bar mitzvah, these are not considered, this is not a live entertainment all of a sudden. And for nonprofits, if suppose a homeless shelter has they put on a play and they charge $20 admission and taking those tickets at fair, they're going to buy canned goods. Nonprofits are exempt. Not because the legislature favors them, nonprofits have a pretty well-established status, but because they're not engaged in profitable economic activity. And all these exemptions separate what you would think of in a common sense way as profitable, business, commercial transactions, and everything else.
It's being asserted that greed is a sea change. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, why not? And is there a case law to draw on that's been developed thus far that goes that way or supports your proposition?
Reed says nothing about taxes. They don't rely on any tax cases. But on the other hand, the U.S. Supreme Court has 50 years of sign ordinance jurisprudence. The First Amendment is a vast area. It's very important in the First Amendment, which, far from being having affected some sea change, it's a very static area of law, and it's full of very carefully crafted categories. It's very important to preserve those categories. Different types of speech, different regulations of speech involve different state interests. I don't see a word in Reed that says anything that suggests that they're trying to alter the standard with respect to taxation laws, which, again, are taxes on business activity.
But Reed purports to bump this up to, as counsel was asserting, a strict scrutiny review, a First Amendment review.
All Reed did is that some United States Courts of Appeals had been drawing a distinction between content-based laws and viewpoint discrimination. And they said, well, you can have content-based laws. You can say, well, you can have political speech but not commercial speech, as long as you don't take a side, Republican, Democrat. All that Reed did is collapse that distinction that some courts or appeals had drawn. The Supreme Court said there's nothing in our jurisprudence that would support that. That's maybe a dramatic thing in that particular area. That's a particular area that involves solely direct regulations of speech. Doesn't touch any of the tax cases. But to put it another way, I mean, we looked at the progeny of Reed. Doesn't seem to have any effect nationwide on tax cases. All the cases they cite in which they say, well, you know, the courts of appeals are reversing themselves, which is kind of a Supreme Court decision. There's a lot of, you know, they grant and vacate and reverse. What those all have in common, every single one of those cases they cite, for the proposition that Reed is this dramatic new departure, they're all direct regulation of speech. Robocalls said you can't use robocalls for political speech or economic speech. Sign ordinances, panhandling laws. These are laws that say you cannot express yourself in this way or on this subject. And that's the distinction that, I mean, the idea that Reed would somehow upend the Supreme Court's taxation jurisprudence, I don't see it. I don't think we will see it. Because, as I say, this is a tax on economic activity. I'm trying to illustrate it. I think that my mind, I mean, I don't know what a tax law would look like that didn't discuss discuss who is being taxed or what's being taxed. I don't think you can frame a tax law that way. And every tax law is brim full of distinctions. I mean, true tax codes make gerrymanders look like models of simplicity, so this is inevitable. NASCAR, but let me illustrate why, and you know, as you said, Deja Vu 1, the key thing was that it's not ideas-based. That's what you can't do. You can't say, oh, we want to favor you. We don't like what you say. We have a cultural favoritism for this certain activity. The two true exemptions I mentioned, NASCAR and Minor League Baseball, explain this. These are economic-based, money-based, hard cash-based things that have nothing to do with ideas. The record is clear. This is how the NASCAR thing came about. The legislature learned two things. They learned that this live entertainment tax, as applied to this one NASCAR race, was bringing in about $1.5 million of a year in the live entertainment tax. But it was bringing $170 million to the Nevada economy overall, a lot of which does come back in tax revenue. It's a big race. People buy stuff, sales, retail, restaurant, taxis, hotels. They also learned that there's only three states in the West that have these tracks, us, Arizona, and California. Arizona and California don't have a live entertainment tax. We're trying to get this race to come here and to stay here. So proposition is that you come to Nevada instantly, 5% of your profits out the door. So they made the hard economic calculation that in order to get this race here, we had to withhold this tax. You put taxes on things to raise revenue. Sometimes, however, you abate a tax, you withhold tax, and also in order to raise revenue. It's the reason the city might abate taxes to get a Hollywood studio to film a movie there. It's better for the economy to have the thing. Because if we lay the tax, NASCAR, this one race, by the way, not all of NASCAR, one race doesn't come here, then guess what? Then we've guaranteed that our tax return on this is $0.00. That's what happened with NASCAR. Pure economics. And the same thing with minor league baseball. We have the Las Vegas 51s. They were the only minor league baseball team in the state. They said this is a new tax. Sales tickets are down. If you lay this tax on us, it might put us out of business. The legislature can say, well, no, we're going to insist on this tax, but it might put you out of business. And then we get no revenue from it, and then we've lost the money. We've lost baseball in Nevada.
That we have the Reno Aces, too, so there's two teams here in Nevada.
Yeah, the Reno Aces came in 2009. And this minor league baseball exception was added in 2005.
I see. Okay.
But that same theory that we want sports to come in Nevada, so the minor league baseball thing is now out. So since 2013, there's an exemption for all major league professional sports. This is because we're one of the until very recently with the NHL, we're one of the 20 half states in the union that do not have a major league sports team. Las Vegas for decades has been the largest city in the country by population, by far, without a professional sports team. These are multi-billion dollar franchises. It makes sense for the legislature to do its utmost to eliminate this embarrassment of not having a professional sports team by eliminating this tax. It's an incentive. It's a lure. This is a classic thing that a legislature does. As I say, it's one of the millions of things that legislatures have to do when they're framing their tax laws. It has nothing to do with ideology or ideas, and I think that's maybe one long way to illustrate the point, Justice Douglas. You could have a case where the legislature wants to tax NASCAR. We would love to get that money from NASCAR. But if we insist on the tax, if we don't give that exemption, we might not get anything from it. And so our hand is essentially forced by Arizona and California. And that happens all the time in taxation jurisprudence.
Mr. Tartakovsky, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Please, Chief. No, please, Chief.
Mr. Tartakovsky, can we be implicated, as suggested by Mr. Ferrario, if within the live entertainment tax the rate is adjusted and that adjustment of rate targets a particular industry? It seems like one could not only implicate greed potentially, by a tax that isn't broad-based but could implicate an industry by setting a different rate for one industry versus another.
Mm-hmm.
Would you address that issue? Mr. Ferrario didn't touch on rate differences, but in the papers they are commented about. And there was an adjustment, I think, in square footage to the facilities that would bring in, as a practical matter, other folks. You both had talked about the New York appellate court case that rejected the notion that Reed would apply in a tax context, but that was a broad-based amusement tax. Here, the argument seems to be that either through rate adjustment or through some other manipulation, Reed's implicated because that has been a targeted business.
So a few points, Justice Hardesty. There were two rates for mm-hmm. most of the period issues. It was 5% if you had a venue that was 75,000 or more, 10% below. In practical terms, that meant 5% applies to casinos, because there's very few facilities in the state that have more than 7,500 seats, maybe 7,000, 7,500 seats that are not casinos. I'm not exactly sure why they had that rate differential. My guess is that in order to look at the tax burden that a particular taxpayer pays, you have to look at the total tax picture. Casinos pay all sorts of taxes that smaller entities don't. So the total tax burden could be closer to 10% in both cases. It was not based, however, it was based on size. But it was not based on the type of entertainment or the substance of the entertainment. So most of the tax, 90% of the tax in the LET is paid by casinos, which makes sense because they have the biggest shows, the biggest concerts, the biggest comedians, Cirque du Soleil. The rest 10% is a far greater number of taxpayers, but they all pay at the same rate. So the strip clubs pay at the same rate. The rodeos and the carnivals and the ballets and the operas and the electric day, you know, whatever it may be. Hundreds of different taxpayers. If there were a tax rate that applied solely to them as an industry, that might be a more complex case. It's not the case here. I don't want to say that you can't do it because some states do do it. There's a case called Bush Co., 2009 Utah case. Utah has a sexually explicit business tax. It's on strip clubs and escorts. The Utah Supreme Court upheld it as a non-content-based tax because they say that nudity, under Erie, the Supreme Court's decision in Erie, nudity is not inherently expressive, so it's under O'Brien, it's content neutral, and they upheld it in that sense.
Can I ask you a question while you still got just a few seconds left?
Yeah.
If I may, Chief.
Sure.
Can you address the jurisdictional argument just briefly?
You're
down and dirty on it.
Yes, Justice Peregrini. It's very simple. You have said time and time again that the filing deadline for a petition for judicial review is mandatory and jurisdictional. You have said that district courts have no inherent power to review agency decisions. You have said this over and over, and then you said it again in 2011 in Southern California Edison. We have maintained in this case since 2006 that this should have been brought as a PGR. In 2011, we bring it to the district court. We say the Supreme Court has said yet again that this is mandatory jurisdictional. And Elizabeth Rescue Voluminous, I think, pinpoint exactly where the legal error occurred. In 2011, the district court is confronted with Southern California Edison. The district court agrees. The court says, you're right, I have no jurisdiction, but I'm going to give you 30 days and you can remand it, on the theory that the court was tolling the statute of limitations.
So you're saying it had no jurisdiction in the first place to even set over the 30 days to file a petition?
It had no more jurisdiction than if you had a state law claim, you brought it to a federal district court, and you goofed, and in doing so you missed the state jurisdictional deadline. The federal court can't say, oh, I have no power to hear this. But, you know, since you're here, why don't you take 30 days, go refile it, because a federal court would effectively be altering the state jurisdictional deadline. And that's exactly what happened here. They had 30 days in addition to the 4 years. You can't toll the statute. May I just finish the thought?
Sure, please.
You can't toll. It's not a matter of tolling a statute of limitations. That's what the district court, that's how they It said, the court said, I don't have the power to exercise jurisdiction. But then it went ahead and exercised jurisdiction by giving them 30 days, effectively altering. It's not a matter of tolling statute of limitations for the simple reason that statute of limitations, and you can waive those. You can fail to assert them as affirmative defenses. You lose them. We can't create jurisdiction. But that's what they, and that's what they said. I think to put a fine point on it, Your Honor, I think that we're here in 2017 arguing over an agency decision that was decided in 2007 because district courts are not heeding for decisions on this point. Mandatory and jurisdictional means mandatory. It means no power, no authority.
Okay, thank you. You answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Tartakovsky. Mr. Brown and Mr. Ferrario, a couple minutes.
I will say just briefly that I think Judge Gonzalez had as much jurisdiction to consider to convert the case into a PJR as the district court did in Southern California Edison, to consider that case as a de novo action, and as the district court did in Tax Department, where Justice Gonzalez did, there was a de novo action filed, and this court actually said this matter should proceed in the district court as a petition for judicial review. The summer of 2011 was significant because in May there's Southern California Edison, where there's a de novo action that results in a continued de novo action in district court. Roughly a month later, July, there's Tax Department, where de novo action results in a petition for judicial review in the district court. Then on August 23rd, you have Judge Gonzalez saying this was a de novo action, but it won't continue as a petition for judicial review. That's exactly what happened per this court's direction in Tax Department versus District Court. And again, that was decided and issued only a month before Judge Gonzalez made her decision. So her decision really mirrored what this court directed should happen in Tax Department versus District Court. Unless there's other questions, I'll let Mr. Ferrario.
Okay, go back to Leathers versus Medlock a little bit. In that case, also, I should have reminded the court that they determined, the justices there determined it wasn't a content-based regulation. Now, we, in Leathers versus
Medlock. I think I misunderstood you. I thought they did determine that it was content-based regulation and it was facial.
No, they actually concluded in there that the law was not content-based, that it was a broadly applied tax. And that what I'm saying now, in terms, if you look at Reed now defines how you look at content-based to determine if something's content-based. You have to look at the message that's being said, and if there's differentiation, that's what we have here. So that was the case I was off on.
Okay.
I want to point to page 16 of our brief because there we cite to legislative history. It talks about the impact of the statute. Justice Hardy, I should have brought that up. There is a differentiation between 10% and 5%. But at the end of the day, here's what we have under Reed. The only way you can determine who is subject to this tax is look at the message that the speaker is sending. And I appreciated the comment and the very good argument from opposing counsel. But he started off by saying, you know, that this is a broadly applied, generally applicable tax. And that's simply wrong. If it was that, we wouldn't be here. This is a gerrymandered tax that was aimed at my clients. And when you have to look at the message that's being sent to determine whether the law applies under Reed, that requires a strict scrutiny analysis. And whether it's a 10% versus 5% differential, or whether it's, you know, we want to promote minor league baseball because it's good for the state, or we want to promote NASCAR. The one thing Reed tells us is, you know, you can have the purest of motives, but if you have to engage in an analysis of the content, strict scrutiny applies. And that's the message of Reed. Thank you.
Hey, can I ask a quick question? So who's paying the other 95% of this? If you're being targeted, you're paying 5%. Where's the other 95% of this message?
You.
That you're saying is being targeted.
The message?
Yeah. Well, what's the other group? Who else is paying the 95%? What other venues, or casinos,
which is the 5-10% thing, they pay a large
they paid a large percentage under the old casino entertainment tax. They're getting charged at 5%, but they can jury-rig the taxation. They can shove more of their revenue over, as we articulated in our brief, to the sale of food and drink, and they don't get impacted by the administrator. We don't have the ability to do that. They have options we don't have. But if you look at the people that are subject to the 10% tax, which is what we're subject to under the changed system, okay, we pay the lion's share of that tax. I don't think there's any dispute as to that. So it's all how you cut the numbers up, and that's why I cite you to what we put in our brief. And it is in the legislative history, as counsel has indicated. We've given you all of that, and all the numbers are there. But, again, I don't know that any of that's relevant anymore under Reed. Because what you have to do to determine if the tax is applicable is you have to look at the message being conveyed. And when you do that under any system, it's because Reed acknowledges that this invites problems. And we're not going to invite problems anymore under Reed. And that's what Reed says. And you have to impose strict scrutiny. And this doesn't satisfy a strict scrutiny analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, Mr. Ferraro, Mr. Tartakovsky. And this case will stand.